5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Coming to you from the friendly confines of the Barrett Sports Media headquarters, which is the fancy way of saying broadcasting live from my home office. I'm Jason Barrett. This is the fourth installment of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. Nice to have you aboard. On this week's episode, the host of the DA show on CBS Sports Radio, Damon Amendolara, drops by for a chat about his sports radio career. First, a quick reminder, if I can trouble you guys to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast on iTunes, you'd really be helping me out a great deal. I love doing this and giving you insight into some fascinating people from the sports radio industry. My hope is you can return the favor by leaving a short sentence or two about the podcast to help us elevate our position on the iTunes charts. I'm also constantly thinking about who'd be interesting to chat with on future episodes of the program. So if you have someone in mind you'd like to hear from on a future show, email me at jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com or hit me up on Twitter at sportsradiopd. For this week's show, I think you're really going to enjoy the conversation I conducted with DA. We went through all of his experiences, got into a number of different topics, and if you're working in sports media right now, or if you're pursuing the business or thinking about pursuing the business, there's some really valuable information in there that I think you'll be able to use to your benefit. In the meantime, though, it's time to get the ball rolling as we do on each episode by introducing this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! According to a report from Sports Illustrated's Richard Deitch, ESPN is looking to slash payroll by tens of millions of dollars. Others are reporting that the payroll reductions could climb as high as $100 million. The cuts are expected to occur between now and June, and those who will be affected will be the ESPN on-air staff. So the faces that you're accustomed to seeing on your television or digital screens may not be there in a few months. Now, those who drink the ESPN Kool-Aid will try to spin it differently, but you've got your head in the sand if you don't think there are bigger problems happening right now at ESPN. And let me be clear about this. I don't enjoy saying that. I spent two of the greatest years of my career working for the company. I have a number of friends still there, and I think the company as a whole does incredibly high-quality broadcast work. But we've got to call a spade a spade. In the past 2.5 years, the network has lost Bill Simmons, Colin Cowherd, Skip Bayless, Jason Whitlock, Keith Olbermann, and Mike Tirico. They've pulled the plug on Grantland. They've watched other notable people such as Tom Jackson, John Kruk, Chris Carter, Chris Broussard, and Kurt Schilling exit or get let go. They've reduced the role of one of the network's founding fathers, Chris Berman. They've lost SportsCenter icon Stuart Scott to a battle, unfortunately, with cancer. And that follows previous departures from other high-profile people such as Dan Patrick, Rick Riley, Doug Gottlieb, Brian Kenny, Rick Bucher, and a few others. Now, to be fair, some of these things are unavoidable. When you're the best sports network in the world and you employ hundreds of great on-air talent, other groups are going to come after what you have. Some people leave because other opportunities are more lucrative. Others bolt because they don't like the roles they're in or they don't feel comfortable about the fit. But in years past, ESPN rarely lost this collection of talent in a short period of time. They may have been the hunted, but you were entering the wrong jungle if you thought you were going to stop them from dominating the sports television business. So what's changed? Well, subscribers continue to drop and have done so since 2011. The network during that time is down 13 million subscribers. That's over 2 million people per year. Most cable operators charge $7 to $8 per month for ESPN on the average person's cable bill. And when you lose $8 a subscriber and 13 million people, that's an estimated financial bath of $104 million per month. Add it up now over the span of 12 months, and you're looking at a devastating decrease in revenue of over $1 billion per year. ESPN, though, has always made money. They could afford to lose $1 billion before because they made it up in ad revenue, and their expenses were under control. But the last time the company was at the negotiating table with the NBA and the NFL, they grossly overpaid for both. The result? They're now shelling out over $7 billion collectively for all of their sports rights. It's very difficult in these changing times to remain profitable in the media industry when a company is saddled by bad contracts and their ad revenues continue to decline. The way most broadcasting companies make up for it is by eliminating the one thing they have control over, employee salaries. For decades, ESPN has been the golden goose that Disney has relied on. They could create a bad TV show or movie, lose millions at the box office, and it didn't matter because ESPN would continue soaring and bail them out. But now that the network has reached its tipping point, stockholders and company executives are freaking out and find themselves in a state of panic, having to make negative life-changing decisions, which they never could have anticipated. This is foreign territory. It feels lately, when I look at the news, that it's all very negative, and I can't stand reporting it. We have ESPN looking to trim payroll and headcounts, Cumulus and iHeart facing bankruptcy possibilities and massive debt. CBS decides to leave the radio industry, luckily striking a deal with the company and Entercom, which at least still believes the business has significant upside. When you hear these stories, it can't make you feel good as a broadcaster. It's why I'm not rooting against Fox Sports 1, HBO, TNT, Bleacher Report, Barstool Sports, or any other TV, radio, print, or digital outlet. If they want to seize opportunity in the sports space and establish themselves as a legitimate contender, even if there are some shows and people that we don't necessarily enjoy, more power to them. We need more people in the space, not less. You know, we get caught up so much, spending our energy and time rooting for the demise of certain shows and personalities, rather than recognizing that their success leads to future opportunities for the rest of us in the sports media space. And when two or three outlets gain traction with viewers, listeners, or readers, and advertisers increase their spending with these brands, it benefits us all. ESPN is not what it once was. It hurt itself by negotiating bad play-by-play deals. They've lost a ton of key talent in a short period of time, which ultimately leads to a decrease in brand loyalty from dedicated fans. They've also pushed a left-leaning agenda which has rubbed many people the wrong way, and they've watched their SportsCenter audience erode over the years as more people have turned to social and digital platforms to get what they need in a shorter amount of time. All of those criticisms are fair, but don't also lose sight of the fact that the company still employs more sports broadcasters than any other outlet broadcasting today. They haven't shied away from paying top dollar for notable people. Case in point, Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, Mike Greenberg, John Gruden, and Bomani Jones. Are they perfect? No, of course not. Are they more vulnerable now than in years past? I think you can easily make that case. But if they fail, it's not a good sign for our industry. And I'd rather see them rebound, continue to make investments that benefit many of you who are listening to this today, than continue the downward spiral they've been on, which undoubtedly is going to hurt many more than just those who will be eliminated over the next few months. None of us can control how they spend their money when they're at the negotiating table with these professional sports leagues. And it's easy to second guess and poke holes in their strategy. But let's not forget one key thing. The National Football League, the National Basketball Association, and Major League Baseball all control their own programming and all have their own television networks. If they wanted to place their games on those networks tomorrow, they could do so. And if they did, it would seriously impact ESPN's business. So did they overpay? Absolutely. But they had to. They were in a no-win situation, Without the National Football League, Major League Baseball, and the NBA, you can bet they would have lost a lot more than 13 million people over the last 6 years. That's something for you to think about when you're writing the narrative of ESPN going forward. You're more than welcome to share your thoughts on this subject, jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com, or you can reach me on Twitter, @sportsradiopd. It's now time to connect with Damon Amendolara, DA as he's known inside industry circles. The CBS Sports Radio host has spent more than a decade in the business, working in numerous local markets across the nation before arriving back in New York, where he presently lives and works. He's gone through his fair share of interesting experiences along the way and was kind enough to share them with me this week on the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
And now, our feature presentation.
All right, so you and I have very similar backgrounds. Currently, you live in Brooklyn, New York.
Yep.
But originally, you're from Orange County, New York, the Warwick area.
That's right.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, now live in the Orange County area, a place I moved to when I was 13 years old. Then your radio career gets started. You begin it in the Southeast region, then move to the Midwest, then to the Northeast, where you're now doing a national radio show. I begin my career in the Northeast, have a stop for 2 years on a network level, move to the Midwest, then the West Coast, and now am back in the Northeast. The parallels are interesting.
This is like a Kirk Cameron, Dudley Moore movie at this point. We're just flipping people and flipping spaces.
So let's go back to the beginning. You're growing up 70 miles away from New York City. I'm guessing you grew up listening to WFAN like many others in this business who are from the New York area. When did you even become interested in sports talk radio?
I listened to WFAN, obviously, because that was the only sports talk in town. And I grew up really in the late 80s and 90s as a big-time sports media consumer, you know. So I was in fourth grade, let's say, in 89, and I'm starting to really kind of take in the sports realm, and that's when the fan is starting to hit its peak. So certainly Mike and the Mad Dog was a huge part of growing up. But the funny thing was, I never wanted to do sports talk. It was never a dream of mine. I thought that I could do play-by-play. I thought that I could maybe be a sports center anchor, but I didn't know specifically which way I was going to go. I just knew that that's something I wanted to do. So in high school, in Warwick, New York, I went to my cable access television station, and I just said, hey, can I do games? Can I just broadcast games? I'll bring a camera from the communications department in my high school, and I'll just talk into a microphone, and will you put them on? And so I got the bug doing play-by-play then, and then I went to Syracuse just to kind of figure out what it was that I wanted. And when I came out of school, I didn't really do a lot of sports talk at Syracuse. I did a pregame show, a postgame show every so often, a weekly show, but it really, that weekly show we only did every, you know, let's say every month, because we had rotating guest hosts. So when I finally got out of school and my first job was in Fort Myers, Florida, I didn't really know if I wanted to be a sports talk host, but I just needed a job. And then that's kind of where my career just kind of took me like the tide.
So you secure the prestigious Syracuse degree, which many in the industry view as the holy grail of broadcast schools. How do you even land on the radar of a sports radio station in Fort Myers, Florida? Were you blindly sending tape, or did you know someone there?
You know, I knew somebody, and it's the old case of say yes to everything. When I was at Syracuse, I became sports director of the student station, WAER, and that called for you as sports director to stay up all summer in Syracuse. So at that time, I said, I can't just be doing sports updates, you know, every morning and stay sane. I need something else. So I called around to radio stations in Rochester, Utica, Albany, Binghamton, and I said, you know, is there anything out there for me to do? I got connected with a guy, Tom Abraham, in Rochester. They were doing soccer on the radio, A-League soccer, the Rochester Raging Rhinos. So he said, well, you know what? We actually could use a pregame and postgame host, so maybe you'd like to do that. So I did 30 games over that summer and into the fall. Tom ended up taking a job after I graduated down in Fort Myers. And then when I came out of Syracuse, I looked for a job forever. I was living at home for nearly a year. I was pulling out my hair. I was living with my parents. I said, I can't do this anymore. And so he called me after about a year when I was living at home. And he said, look, I know that you need something. You want something. We've got like 10 hours a week doing pre and post game for Arena Football 2, the minor league arena for the Florida Firecats. I said, I'm in. So I just loaded up my my 93 Chevy Lumina. I put all my clothes in it, and I just drove to Florida. And I said, I don't care if it's 10 hours and the rest of the income I need is going to be made up at the mall or something. I'm just going to go do it because I needed to do it. That ended up launching me into a full-time job there as like a producer, board op, engineer, update guy, a little bit of everything. Then I filled and hosted a bunch of shows. And then that's really where I got a good enough tape to get a talk show job because they eventually gave me my own show after being down there a year. And then I had a daily show that I could send out that tape. I mean, that's how I landed the Kansas City job.
Okay, you brought up Kansas City. So speaking of that stop, who was the PD at the time who first noticed you?
That was Matt Fishman, who was the PD at Sports Radio 610 in Kansas City. It was 610 Sports originally branded because they had an old school, longtime country station that we were taking over, 610 Country or 61 Country. So then we became 61 Sports. Then we were 610 Sports. So there was a lot of iterations of this. Matt Fishman was the PD. Lorna Gladstone, though, was the kind of the talent acquisition person, the consultant on that. And they were looking for a nighttime host with a lighter side of sports. And a friend of mine who was looking for a job saw this posting and said, you know, I feel like that's kind of a good way to describe your show. And so I said, yeah. And I didn't think I was going to get the job. And this is the way that it always works. I said, I got no shot. I've only been hosting a daily show for a year in Fort Myers. Not even. I think I was on the air for 6 months, actually. I said, I don't have enough experience to get to a major market. And Kansas City, for me at that time, was two professional sports teams. It was a top 35 market. But sure enough, I think they liked that I came cheap, that I had a lighter side of sports. And when you look at that original roster, it's amazing. Jason Whitlock was the afternoon drive. Jim Rome was our middays. And then Bill Moss and Tim Grunhard, two former Chiefs greats, were the mid-morning show. And then after that, when I was there, Nick Wright was there.
There's also Danny Parkins, Sean Sharif, Bob Fesco. A lot of good talent has come through that place.
One of my producers, Jonah Ballow, ended up, he's now the lead digital media content guy for the Knicks at Knicks.com. He runs Knicks.com. He does all the interviews there and everything. So it was just amazing to look back and how much talent was actually there.
I learned when I moved to the Midwest that it takes time to connect there. People don't want an aggressive, in-your-face personality on the air. They want someone who's informative, entertaining, but also even keel. So being a New York guy, now working in Kansas City, how long did it take you to adjust to the market?
I took it really seriously. I had never been to Kansas City. When they offered me the job, I called all my friends and my family. I said, has anybody been to Kansas City? Has anybody even had a layover in Kansas City? And nobody had. And so I said, I need to fly out there just to see what this is. Because, I mean, it was totally inconceivable, really, to just move to a place that I didn't know anybody who would ever even step foot in. So I went out there, and I really liked the it was an Entercom company. I really liked the direction of it. They wanted to take on the existing powerhouse in town, Sports Radio 810 WHB. And it was this kind of new, fun, like, let's go after them aggressively. And I really liked that. So I signed to the dotted line, and I took it really seriously because I knew I was walking into a market that I really didn't have any knowledge about, and I knew that being the one non-Kansas Cityan, I was going to be scrutinized, and especially young. You know, I was 23 when I got that job, so I ended up buying every book about the Chiefs' history. I went to Barnes & Noble and got every book about the Royals. I read the Kansas City Star online religiously for, you know, the month before I got that job and moved out there. And then when I went out there, it was the best thing that could have happened to me. And I wish that every broadcaster that grew up in the Northeast or just wanted to settle in their dream city would go to a place that's completely different. Because it taught me so much more about doing a show. I see a lot of guys that come out of school and then just want to be at WFAN and they just stay there. Or they go to, 98.5 The Sports Hub in Boston, or they go to KNBR in San Francisco or whatever. And that's the only thing they know. And if you have never gone and been fish out of water and tried to teach yourself every day and been on the high wire act, I just don't think you're as good. And those years in Kansas City, and then I did Miami, and then I did Boston as a New Yorker in Boston, made me the sports talk host that I am because every call that you take is the potential for you to get exposed. So it is stressful. It forces you to be better. And you can't just lean on cliches because you have to be part of this culture. So I just, those are some of my fondest memories. That station was amazing for me until the end.
So you spend 4.5 years in Kansas City before you got the call to move to Miami, which is a completely different sports market. However, there are also a lot of transplants there. So did that work to your benefit?
It helped because so few people are from Miami. It didn't matter that I wasn't from Miami, I think, in the listeners' eyes. It was really hard, though, from a technical standpoint, because I did the 6 to 9 show at night. And at night, 560 as a signal had a power down. So you could barely hear us most places in Miami by the time I came on the air. And you're only 90 miles from Cuba. And Havana has a 560. So when you were driving around Miami, you would hear, like, Castro's speeches over me.
You could have just played it off like he was your partner.
Neil Rogers was there at the time, right. And he was a Miami sports radio legend. And he didn't really do sports. He did everything else, lifestyle. But he used to make fun of me on the air. He called me and said a D-A-D-O because I got zeros in the rating book. And I said, Neil, you can't kill me on this. If people listen to me, they're listening to state-run Cuban radio. This is not my fault, Neil. So that was why it was really difficult. And also, there's just, unless it's the Dolphins, which you can really talk 365, the Heat weren't LeBron Heat when I was there. The Marlins were always everybody, the scorn of everybody's existence. And nobody cares about the Panthers. You did a little bit of the University of Miami football, but again, they were in the middle of 6-6 years with Randy Shannon. So for my 2 years in Miami, you know, you felt like you were talking to just the crickets out there sometimes.
Now, CDA, this is information that would have been helpful to my case years ago, because what the audience is going to learn right now is that I came calling your way back in 2008.
Yeah.
I was building 101 ESPN, reached out to you, brought you to town, even did a test show in the production studio with you and Brian Burwell. If I remember right, you had only been in Miami a few months at that time, so the timing wasn't necessarily great. Now that we're 9 years past that, though, tell me, what didn't I do in that pitch to convince you to join me?
It was actually nothing that you didn't do. My whole career has been based on, I hope, mutually respectful relationships. I didn't have an agent for the first 10 years of my career because I wanted to represent myself. I wanted to go into a program director's office and have them know me. And so when I got to QAM in Miami, I think I'd only been there 3 months by the time. And that was going to be hard for me because I didn't want, because they put on a really nice push to get me out of Kansas City because I was very comfortable in Kansas City. They promised me a lot of things that didn't end up coming to fruition necessarily, but they said they wanted me to help build a youthful vigor at the station because it had gotten really old. And I had a loyalty to them. Number two, one thing that I always had as a goal was to get back to the Northeast because I had been away from my family for a long time. I'm from a really close family. And having gone to Fort Myers, Florida, then Kansas City, then Miami, I had been gone from them for about 8 years. And I just said, if I go back to St. Louis, I'm tracking away from geographically where I wanted to be. So I just felt like, you know, at this point in time, I think I just need to stay here out of loyalty and out of staying closer to where my goal was. I would say 3 months to 6 months after we spoke and I declined the offer, I regretted that.
But it all turned out all right, because after about a year and a half in South Florida, Boston calls, and now you're on your way to the Sports Hub.
Yeah, and that was a career-defining moment for me because when I was at QAM is when the stock market crashed, the economy crashed in 08 and then the start of 09. They were going to strip down the radio station to have just like national programming, nothing local, very few local shows, and they didn't know what they were going to do. They were ripping staffing apart, and that's what I mean in terms of being regretful because I said, oh my God, how could you see that the bubble bursting economically, but then that whole station was going to go through major turmoil. So about 6 months after that is when CBS started flipping all of those FM rock stations across the country to sports. And Mark Chernoff called me and he said, do you have any interest in leaving? And I said, yeah. I mean, it depends on the job, but yeah. And they asked if I'd be interested in Dallas. And for the same reason I said no to St. Louis and you, I said no to Dallas simply because it was taking me farther away from where eventually I wanted to go. So then it was D.C. or Boston they brought up that they were flipping those two. And I said either one would work. And I thought D.C. might be better because there's more transplants there. A New Yorker in Boston might not do so well. Mark called me back and said, I think Boston is the play. Are you ready for that? And I said, if you believe in me, then I believe in me, and let's do it. And that was the biggest thing that could have happened in my career, because that station went from launch to number one and overtaking WEEI within a calendar year. And to be part of maybe the most powerful sports radio station in terms of success, ratings, in the country, and be part of that really put me on the map in a lot of ways. And it was amazing to watch. I mean, it didn't make any sense. I mean, it would be like somebody taking over WFAN as a startup and taking them down within a year. I mean, just, it's impossible to think that that could happen. It's unfathomable. And it did. And so that really defined my career in a lot of ways.
So give me the secret. How does a New York guy connect on the air in Boston?
A little bit of a pinch of really doing my homework. It mattered to me to get this right, because I didn't want to walk in and be under scrutiny and be like, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And they thought I was from Florida. Everybody there was like, oh, you're from Miami? That's not even a real sports town. And I'm like, no, I'm from New York, actually. I don't know if that's better or worse here. Also, I didn't wear it on my sleeve. I didn't say every night, you know, I'm a big so-and-so. I'm a big New Yorker. You know, the Boston teams stink. I try to be deferential. I try to respect the culture and the sports fandom. And I had a real affinity for Boston because my cousin went to BU. He was a diver there. He went on a full diving scholarship. And so I went up there all the time to visit him. And we went to Red Sox games and went to Celtics games and everything. So I knew of the culture. And then my brother went to Emerson. And so another 4 years I was up there constantly. And those were the 90s and early 2000s before things got really good. So I loved that desperation and urgency to win, and this like overwhelming negativity that Boston does better than anybody else. And I got to say, it's a little bit less fun now, because with all the winning, all of that old school baked in urgency, desperation. My favorite quote ever in Boston is, the Red Sox killed my grandfather, they killed my father, and they're coming for me. And now with all of the winning, you don't have that anymore, you know, and it's made it less fun. But Boston fans don't want to hear that. I had a natural affinity and respect for that. And so going up there was very easy to be respectful of what was going on. And I knew, man, I was under a heat lamp. There was Chad Finn doing sports media.
Yeah, it's treated there like the market's fifth professional franchise.
Yes. And so I knew I was going to be scrutinized, and I knew I had to be on point. And so I tried my damnedest to not screw it up. And that was an amazing, amazing 4 years there.
So you strike a chord in Boston. Now you're under the CBS umbrella. They decide they're going to launch a national sports network in New York, and they want you to be a part of it. Given your travels to Kansas City, South Florida, Boston, and your New York roots, those experiences should come in handy on a national stage. But as I'm sure you've learned now over the past few years, performing and succeeding in national radio is a lot different than operating on a local level. So what ultimately made you decide to pursue it and give up your spot at the Sports Hub?
In Boston, I knew I was never going to move up in time slot, because every time slot was number one, basically. Toucher and Rich in the Morning became an institution. Felger and Maz were the most popular and still are the most popular sports radio show in that market. And at the time, Gresh and Zoe were crushing it as well. And so I said, well, none of these guys are leaving. So what am I going to do? Am I going to do nights for 20 years here? That wasn't part of my equation. As much as I loved it, that wasn't going to be reasonable for me. Number two, going back to New York and being close to my family, I'd worked really hard to try to get as close as possible to my fam, and being within 4 hours in Boston was close, but still not where you can pop home for Sunday dinner and then, you know. So that was really important. And then number three was the trust that I had in Eric Spitz and Mark Chernoff. When I was in Kansas City and when I was in Miami, I would come home on vacations, on breaks, Christmas, summer, whatever, and just ask them, can I fill in on the fan? And so on my vacation days, I was working, but they gave me overnight shifts on the fan when I was young, and then it became evening shifts. And I think they trusted me, and I felt like I could trust them, because you don't want to jump to a startup network like that and not feel like you had support and you didn't have backing. And I had known them for a really long time. Also, I actually think I'm better suited as a national host, because sometimes I feel really constrained by local radio. I mean, you talk about the same three stories every single night. I mean, and in Boston, it could be the same one story every night for a month. I mean, we did entire weeks based on who the starting corners of the Patriots were going to be, or what's going to happen with Mark Melanson in the Red Sox bullpen. I mean, we did weeks on that. And that can be relentlessly fatiguing because everybody else is coming in for 20 minutes. You're doing, and I was doing a five-hour show in Boston. I'm doing 20 hours a week on the same topic sometimes. And I'll never forget, I'm a huge college football fan. And I said, you know, Boston, college football doesn't matter around here, but maybe I can figure out a way to do it. So we did a Notre Dame hit because Notre Dame's a national brand, Irish Catholic community in Boston. I said, this will work. And I'll never forget the first call after the hit. DA, don't you know this is Boston? Nobody cares about college football, dude. Get back to the Patriots. There you go. All right. So when I got to go, I do 4 hours, three segments an hour. I get to do 12 different segments every night. And that fulfills me every single day because it's a totally different show every night.
So you make the move, start building some traction. You're near your family. Then all of a sudden one day, you find yourself in the news because Mike Francesa doesn't like the CBS Sports updates and particularly doesn't like guys who use their initials on the air. This is the guy you've grown up listening to. You've even interviewed him while you were in high school.
Yeah.
And now the biggest voice in New York sports media is coming for you. Take me through what you were thinking and feeling that day when it happened and how you handled it.
What's amazing is that I'm on 180 affiliates every single night. I've carved out what I hope is a pretty successful career in sports talk radio and done a bunch of other things that I'm really proud of. And the only thing I'll ever be remembered for is that Mike Francesa hates my initials. That's going to be my sports media epilogue. That's going to be on my tombstone. So I'm filling in one day for the Gottlieb show, and I'm filling in with Bart Scott, and it's the middle of the summer. And when I fill in for Doug, I've got to record two or three CBS Sports Minutes that run across the network, including on The Fan. It's like July 8th. There's nothing going on. It might have even been the All-Star break. So there is literally no sports going on, and I've got to come up with 3 1-minute hot takes. There was the day that Hulk Hogan...
This has to be when Hogan was caught on tape delivering the racially charged rant and was then fired and eliminated from the entire history books of the WWE.
So that was one of my minutes. And when I do this, everybody calls me DA. Everybody. Nobody calls me my full name, Damon Amendolar. It's long, it's mouthy, it's wordy, it's Italian. So everyone calls me DA, which when I went to Kansas City, they said, we got to do something about your name.
Well, I could see why Mike wouldn't want to use his initials.
So when I do these, I say, this is Damon Amendolar with your CBS Sports Minute. And then I sign off, this is DA. Because if I just said my full name, there's 80% of my audience wouldn't even know who I was by my full name. So I did both. Mike, I think, A, hated that a Hulk Hogan rant was on his show. B, hates the CBS Sports Minutes in general. And C, thought that I was certainly not a big enough name to be only going by initials. So he just starts laying into me on the air, saying, I wouldn't know what this guy is if he was sitting next to me in the hallway. If he was in the studio, I wouldn't know what this guy is, okay? I mean, what's he doing using his initials? What is this, a Hulk Hogan? I mean, come on. So I don't even know this is happening because I'm on the air, and people are tweeting at me like, Mike is going after you right now. And I say, what? This is surreal. I have no idea. I'm trying to do this a show with Bart Scott, who is as ADD and as high energy, hypertension as you could possibly find. So I'm trying to, like, it's like herding cats. And I'm like, wait a second. And Mike is blasting me on the studio next door? So then I kind of, like, pieced it together. And during a commercial break, I went outside and I saw him. And I went up to him. I said, hey, Mike, I just wanted to cut the tension. Like, I'm really sorry about using my initials on the air. Kind of like tongue in cheek. And he was like, oh, you know, it's not about the initials. It's about these sports minutes and Hulk Hogan and wrestling. And then he just like kind of laid into the CBS Sports Minute. So I realized it wasn't really about me. It was really about the CBS Sports Minute. But in doing so, he totally trashed me. Basically said I have no reputation in the industry and wouldn't know me if I was in the studio. And I thought that that was unfair because, as you said, I had interviewed him in high school for a communications project, which might actually show up in the 30 for 30 about Mike and the Mad Dog. And number two, I see him in the hallway all the time. And this guy knows exactly what happens on the network all the time. He's totally plugged in. So he knows who I am. Right. So to just like trash me as I have never accomplished anything, I thought was a bit of a low blow, but we got past it. And I'm telling you, it's when you type in my name to Google, the first thing that comes up is my name and then Mike Francesa feud.
So then the big question is, if you were to take the Pope's chair in the future, would it come with his blessing?
That's a great question. I feel like I'm on thin ice already, you know, with the initials thing. So I don't know where I stand in Mike's book.
So it's probably best to let that one slide for now. All right. I want to wrap up with a few quick hitters in a second. But first, I want to pick your brain on the way you use social and digital media. You're very active on Twitter. You have a podcast. You've also developed the Nomad video series. Why do you think it's so important for talent now to be active in these places?
Well, radio itself is crumbling in some ways in terms of how we consume it. So, you know, while I'm not young, I'm 37, and I understand that there's a generation of my listeners that don't consume it by punching in the radio anymore. They consume it by their phones. They consume it on the computer. They consume it in podcast form. And so I just feel like you can sit there and do 4 hours of radio every day, but that is now only getting to a certain percentage of your audience or of your potential audience. And that was different 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. But now social media is almost your window to your show. And so I tweet as much as possible. We do a podcast on top of, which is like an off-the-air podcast, the Permission Granted podcast. I do the Nomad video series, which my hope is that one day that's actually a television show in some way, because sometimes sports talk can be limiting to just do like piping hot takes every night. You know, you kind of want to spread your wings a little bit, and exploration of games and food and sports fandom and culture is something that I'm interested in. But it's all ways to bring people inside the tent. And if I just ask people to punch in their AM radio station every night, luckily sometimes it's going to be on FM in some markets, I'm going to get lost in the shuffle a lot. Here is one of the great kind of difference makers in media now. There's a lot of people that don't watch basketball games. They go to their app to watch Instagram highlights of what happened in the game. So in the same way, for me, they're not listening to 4 hours of my show. They're going to listen to snippets. They're going to check my Twitter for takes. They're going to check my SoundCloud maybe for snippets. They're going to watch maybe a Nomad video, which is only 9 minutes and not 4 hours. And that's all ways you have to try to bring them in, and hopefully they like you, and then they want to consume more of what you're going to bring to the table.
That makes a ton of sense. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up with five quick hits. Give me the first thing that comes to your mind. The PD who's taught you the most in this business is?
Mark Chernoff.
Toughest market you've worked in is?
Boston.
Biggest career regret?
Not coming to St. Louis.
Well, that's the way to play up to the host for sure.
Not a lot of regrets. I'm one of those guys that where the chips are falling is where they're supposed to fall. It can be frustrating sometimes if they don't fall your way. This is a business that's filled with jealousy and competition and comparison, and I fall into that same thing as well. But everything that I've been through has taught me enough to get to where I am now. And with every step of the way, I'm not the host that I was without it. So even though some things ended poorly, I mean, Miami ended up being quite the challenge. There was never anything that I would take back, because what I do today is an accumulation of everything else that I've done.
The sports radio format's number one weakness is?
Not thinking about your listener. A lot of hosts think about themselves. What do they want to talk about? How do they want to talk about it? We very rarely think about how people want to consume it, what people want to hear. And it can be fatiguing sometimes, as I was talking about before, but you've got to think through their lens. And we just don't do that. And we've also been doing sports talk now for 30 years. And there's some people that just think it's the same way it should have been done 30 years ago. And it's not. The world changed. And a lot of people still are doing radio from 30 years ago.
And the final one, what's the one goal still left in your sights?
I would love for Nomad to be my television outlet. I love doing a sports talk show, and I don't think that I would ever not be doing sports radio, because I really like it, and it scratches that itch for me. But I really would love to do something different in sports television. We now just have Embrace Debate and the Hot Take Express, and that's where sports television's going, and that's not fulfilling to me, because I'm doing that for 4 hours on the radio anyway. Doing something else in sports that's showing not the topic of the day and ripping it apart and crushing somebody, but instead the really positive parts of sports and why it brings us together and why it unifies us and why it inspires us. We don't do enough of that. We just take Tony Romo and blast either Romo, the Cowboys, the Jets, the Broncos, and it's, you know, we get caught in this very small perspective, and I want to do something bigger than that, and so that's why I kind of launched Nomad to do that.
This was a lot of fun, and to think we did it inside of an athletic director's office inside of Goshen High School in upstate New York. your cousin's spot to be exact. My thanks to him, but more importantly, my thanks to you. Appreciate the time today, and all the best going forward.
You too, Jay.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was DA, Damon Amendolara of CBS Sports Radio, here on the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. There are a number of things that stood out from that conversation. First, I didn't know that there was a Havana radio station battling QAM for 560's airwaves at night. As an out-of-town talent relocating, trying to build traction in a new market, yeah, I could see why that would be frustrating when you're trying to do a show and you're not sure if it's being consumed because everyone is listening to Havana radio on your air. The second thing that stood out, imagine growing up listening to Mike and the Mad Dog, working for 10 years to finally make it back home to New York, where you now work for CBS Sports Radio and are a colleague of Francesa. You walk down the hall to find out he's destroying you on the air in your own backyard where your family are probably listening to him. I'm sure that could not have been a comfortable day at the office for DA. And yes, there is something to be said for any publicity is good publicity. But I'm sure over the next two decades of his career, DA would like to be known for something a little more meaningful than being put on blast by the Pope of New York sports. The other item I want to touch on is when he talked about not accepting opportunities in markets where he felt it would pull him further away from New York. Although it did not work out for me favorably when I was going after DA in 2008, I give him a ton of credit for that because he had a set vision for where he wanted to go, and he stayed in a situation that wasn't better at the time because it put him on track to get to where he needed to be long term. That's a good strategy. Not every talent is willing to do that. Sometimes guys chase opportunities because a good market comes calling, and rather than looking at whether or not they fit that situation best or whether it puts them closer to where they truly want to be long term, they just rush to the job and ultimately fall on their face in a year or two. There are always going to be short-term challenges and sacrifices you have to make when you're working in this industry. DA was willing to pay the price. It landed him in Boston, where he had a great run at the Sports Hub. And now he's on the national airwaves doing a nice job for CBS Sports Radio. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation. That's going to conclude this edition of the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. My thanks to Damon Amendolara for dropping by and to you for spending your time listening to this broadcast. Don't forget, an iTunes review makes a big difference and it costs you nothing but 30 seconds of your time. Help us spread the word by leaving a comment or two about what you thought of this episode. One thing I'd like to pass along, be sure to check out the website, sportsradiopd.com, over the next week. I've been working on a piece which I think is going to generate some industry opinion and debate. I don't write material with an agenda or to provoke any particular individual or company, but I'm also a firm believer that the industry doesn't get better if we don't have consistent conversations about ways to improve it. Although some topics may be uncomfortable from time to time, we only make progress if we remain open-minded to different viewpoints, facts, and ideas. And if one person helps their brand succeed more tomorrow due to a conversation we explored, then it's well worth my time to attack it. Kid Rock once said, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So leave it all out on the airwaves and treat your audience to something special. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.